Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for joining us today. I want to say a big thanks to everybody who contributed during our spring membership drive. We had more than, I think it was 1,500 people, listeners pledging, 350 new members. We planted 800 trees in Wisconsin, donated over $275,000. And a big thanks as we move into the next 100 years of Wisconsin public radio programs that you love. And tell you what, we're going to talk about insurance coverage today, among other things. I think a lot of people think of insurance as a necessary evil, perhaps, and it can be a complicated one at times, and that's why we have Mike Riley with us. Michael Riley is a third-generation Madison attorney, a partner in the Axley Law Firm in Madison, and can answer your general legal questions and take some of the confusion out of buying insurance that might be right for you. You may have questions about insurance coverage, personal injury as well, we'll get into. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Just look for the Larry Mueller Show. And tell you what, looking forward to visit with him and looking forward to visiting with you as well. So give a call or shoot us a note. Love to hear from you. And Michael Riley, welcome back.
Great to be back, Larry.
Let's start with auto insurance first. And what is covered by law? What coverage is required by law?
Sure. In Wisconsin, we now require that you have a 25-50 policy. And most policies are what we call split limits. So the 25 means the 25,000 is the most the policy will pay for any claims that come from one person being injured in an accident. The 50,000 is the most total they'll pay no matter how many people are injured in the accident. For a while, we had 100, 300. Under the previous administration, we had 100, 300 requirement, which in my mind was much more realistic. And it's a coverage that we probably see more than any other. The problem with 25,000, let's focus on that number, is that we see cases on a regular basis, Larry, where the emergency room bills are 20,000 or sometimes even more. If they do, someone has a head injury, they do a CAT scan, they do an MRI, they do a number of those studies. And just if you get a significant injury, they do what they call trauma activation, which means they bring in a bunch of specialists into the ER to be ready to deal with whatever the injury may be. And just that can cost an awful lot of money. So if you injure someone else, and we're talking now about liability insurance, and liability insurance covers you if you're at fault and you cause somebody else an injury. So that's what we're focusing on right now. You know, I think people should have a minimum of 100, 300. That's, again, 100,000 for one single person and their claim up to 300,000. There certainly can be claims that go beyond that, but I think that is a responsible limit. And it's also a limit that will allow you to buy umbrella coverage from most companies.
Alan in Superior wondered whether or not it was important to have umbrella insurance, and maybe just what is umbrella insurance and what?
Sure. Umbrella coverage is the coverage that comes over and beyond your basic coverage. So if you have you won't be able to buy an umbrella with a 25-50 policy. Some companies might require the 250,000, 500,000 limit. Most, I think, will sell it to you at the 100,000/300,000. And that makes sense because most injuries aren't that severe. I mean, yeah. We see a lot of cases in a given year. The vast majority are not more than 100,000. Many, many of them are more than 25,000. The umbrella policy steps in once that basic coverage has been exhausted. So if somebody has a bad injury and it's worth more than the 100,000, then your basic underlying liability limits will pay the 100,000, and then you go to the umbrella. Umbrellas can be written for lots of different amounts. I'm sure there are people who have umbrellas for, you know, tens of millions, but the 1 million is normally the minimum that they write umbrellas for. And again, you can buy them for a little bit more. One thing that's important to remember is that on the basic policy or on the umbrella, as you add coverage, if you go from 2550 to 100, 300, it certainly costs more, but it's not proportional.
Yeah.
The biggest cost you pay is for the basic coverage because, you know, that's the risk. I mean, you're going to have any kind of accident and injure somebody. As it goes up, the amount goes up, the amount you're paying proportionally goes down. So umbrella policies are relatively inexpensive compared to the primary coverages that we've been talking about, the 2550 or 100, 300. You can buy 250, 500. There are lots of different limits. Some companies also write single limits so that they'll have a single limit that says, okay, we're going to give you 100,000. Doesn't matter how many people are hurt, or 300,000, which is fairly common. Again, just a single limit. Whether it's one person or many, that's your limit. But the question was, is it important to have an umbrella? If you have significant assets, if you've got a home with a small mortgage, you know, if you own other property, if you have significant investment property and you want to be sure you're protected, you should have an umbrella. And you should talk to your agent about how much. But one other thing, and we'll talk a little bit about uninsured and underinsured as time goes on, but in terms of the umbrella, I think it's really important to make sure you have underinsured motorist coverage. That's coverage, and uninsured motorist coverage.
Yeah.
Those are coverages that protect you if someone has no insurance or if they don't have enough insurance. And they're protecting you. So that if you're injured and they don't have enough coverage, you go to your own company. And go either, if they have no coverage, you go to your uninsured motorist coverage. If they have some coverage, for instance, 2550, but it's not nearly enough to take care of your injury and compensate you for your injury, then you go to your own underinsured motorist coverage.
And the uninsured is required by law, isn't it?
You're right. The uninsured is required by law, so everybody has that. The underinsured is not required by law. What the law says is that the company has to offer you underinsured motorist coverage, but if you reject it or simply don't respond, they don't have to include it in the policy automatically. And we see just an unfortunate number of people who should have underinsured motorist coverage and don't. They get in an accident, and again, somebody has a minimum limits policy or even a policy that's more than that but is just far less than is needed to compensate for the injury. And so it's really important to make sure your agent gives you that coverage. I think agents sometimes, I've testified a lot up at the hearings in the Capitol, and it's been surprising to me over the years. I think agents are really good people. I think some of them are very capable and very knowledgeable, but it's surprising to me the gaps in some of their knowledge, at least, about these coverages. So make sure the agent gives you your underinsured coverage on your basic policy and on your umbrella policy if you choose to buy one.
Mike Riley, our guest today, talking with him, zeroing in a little bit on insurance right now and talking personal injury with him as well. You can call in with your own questions or experiences at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You know, years ago I was in I had homeowners insurance, but I left for a year and to go to Trinidad, and I rented a home in Trinidad, and my home was looted at one point. And I just called my insurance agent to see if I was going to be covered, and he said, "Oh, yeah, you're covered." And I was so happy because it was a fairly large amount of, you know, property that was taken. We should all have that as well. Homeowners or renters insurance.
Right. Homeowners, you almost have to have. If you have a mortgage on your home, your mortgage lender is going to say, "I want to be sure there's insurance there." So that's usually not as big a problem. The one thing that you should do with homeowners, well, there are a number of things you should do, but one of them that's a real concern is make sure that, one, you've got enough coverage, because in the real estate market, you know, we've been up and down and now back up again. And if you bought your home a lot of years ago, which many of us did, or you purchased a home during one of the troughs, you know, when things were a little lower, you want to be sure there's enough coverage there. And there are some provisions in the policy that may adjust it, but you should make sure that they don't just put on cost of inflation, because inflation, housing prices in a lot of cases have outstripped cost of inflation by a good bit. And so it's important to just check with your agent when you buy the policy, find out what you need to do. Do you need to come back periodically and do a refresher? Some agents will ask you, you know, they'll send you something out and say, we ought to talk or, you know, make sure. But that doesn't happen all the time. So it's important to know about that. The other thing is there are basically two kinds of coverage. There is a coverage that's sort of actual cash value, which means what's the house worth, or more to the point, if you have to put new shingles on your roof, are you going to get what it actually costs you to do that? Which actual cost value sounds like that, but it's not. Because what actual cost value means is we're going to say, what are those shingles worth less depreciation? So if you had been on the roof for 10 years, they're not going to pay you to put new shingles on. They're going to pay you what it would have cost, you know, less the depreciation. If you get replacement value coverage, and I think probably most policies are written for that, but absolutely you should have that, because then if something happens, you get what it actually costs to replace the shingles, not just what the shingles are worth in effect at that point. So, you know, that's one of those things that's important. You know, it's funny you talked about renter's insurance, because I just met with a client this morning who was at a good friend's home, and it's a rented home, a rented duplex, and the friend's dog attacked her and really bit her pretty viciously. And, you know, the medical costs and everything are going to be very substantial. And that the person, you know, really hopefully has renter's insurance and hopefully has an adequate policy limit. Because, again, this is a good example of something where the medical bills in this case may well exceed $100,000 by the time we're through. So not only having the coverage, and that's true with homeowners, too. A lot of homeowners' policies may be written with like $100,000 in liability coverage. And, you know, homeowners covers you both at home. I mean, if somebody's at your home and you haven't properly fixed the carpet on the stairs and they slip and tumble and injure themselves, you know, if they slip on ice on your stoop in the winter, and some of these injuries can be significant. I mean, people don't bring lawsuits or even claims. Sometimes if you slip and you bump your bottom, which I've done once or twice in my career. I always remember I was out visiting a client and I walked out. They said, walk out the front door, and I'd come in the back, and I walked out, and it was a winter day, and it was snowy. There was snow all over, but sunny. It was just bright, and I could barely see the stoop, which turned out to be black ice. And I still remember my briefcase sailing up in the air doing somersaults while I came down and fortunately landed on a cushioned area, but, you know, and I wasn't hurt, and that was fine. But those things can happen, and that one was sort of funny, but a lot of them aren't. And the other dog bite's a really good example. I mean, a dog bite, especially to the face, and unfortunately they often happen to children because kids are at that level, but in this case it was an adult, and those can be really devastating. Those can be really serious injuries, and they can be expensive. So, you know, $100,000 is not a lot of money, and if you can buy a higher liability limit, you should talk to your agent about that and talk about what you have and what you're trying to protect, because, again, you can get an umbrella policy that will cover that as well, and often your umbrella policy does. Just be sure, you know, when you talk to the agent, it's important that they understand. People often go in and just say, well, what's the minimum limit? Or, you know, what do you think is a normal limit? And I think what you see more often in our state than any other is probably the 100, 300 limit. But that really isn't enough money in some cases. Again, if you don't have any assets, somebody's probably going to take whatever insurance you've got and call it quits. But, you know, you can have an injury that's serious enough where people won't do that or can't do that. And if that happens, boy, it's really important that you protect yourself.
Mike Riley, our guest today, partner in the Axley Law Firm in Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheryl Gasser, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on the Kathleen Dunn Show, she will be discussing with a reporter a new investigation into why millions of dollars of unused medical supplies and prescription drugs are wasted every year. That's at 2 o'clock today. Right now, we're taking a look at personal injury law, taking a look at insurance, zeroing in on that with Mike Riley of the Axley Law Firm of Madison. And we'll take some calls. All our lines are full. John in Sturgeon Bay, thank you for calling. Hi, what's on your mind?
Good morning. So try to sum this up. What about a sole proprietorship and converting that into an LLC? And I have a $2 million umbrella policy. My wife and I run a part-time wilderness guiding business up north. And is that a, if I go move that to an LLC and change that to an LLC, can I still do an umbrella policy on my original insurance?
I'm sure you can. I mean, you want to make sure that the LLC was covered, was named as an insured on the policy, but you'd also want to be named personally. There's nothing wrong with an LLC. It's a good idea. I'm not a corporate guy, but I'm sure our corporate people would encourage you to do that. The one thing about incorporation is I hear, as you, I'm sure, do these things on commercial radio all the time where they're trying to sell you on the notion if you just incorporate, then all your problems are solved and nobody can take anything. And, you know, that may be true under some circumstances. It's not invariably true. A corporation doesn't always protect you. If you do incorporate, there are certain things you have to do, like registering and staying current and probably having meetings occasionally. It's really important to do that because otherwise somebody can come along and do what they call piercing the corporate veil, where they say, you know what, you're really only a corporation in name, and you know you really aren't a real corporation, so we should be able to get at you personally. So what I do is make sure you've got both the LLC and yourself covered under the umbrella and talk to the agent about that. I don't think that should be a problem. It's a great idea to have that coverage, and as you could probably attest, it's not all that expensive. I mean, compared to the underlying coverage, an umbrella is really a bargain for the amount of protection you get. And it's really a good idea. Things happen. It's not common. I think people think that the threats of lawsuits in areas other than driving your car, you know, are looming over them all the time. And the reality is it just doesn't happen very often at all. I've worked with all sorts of sports organizations. And one of the questions that always comes up is, you know, do we need this? What about this? And the answer is, of course, you should have insurance. But the threat is really not nearly as great as people think it is. But that doesn't mean not to have the insurance, and you're smart to get it for both the LLC and yourself.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Scott in Waukesha, it's your turn. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Larry. My question is going back to the auto insurance. I have a $500,000 limit, but it's not tiered. It's just a straight $500,000. It's not $250,000, $500,000.
Yeah, it's a single limit policy.
I'm wondering if, that's worth it. The extra cost isn't that much, but is it worth it? So does that mean, like what you were saying, it covers an individual up to $500,000 and the entire accident up to $500,000?
Yes, I think it is worth it. You're right. That is what it means. So the difference is, obviously, if you're in an accident and there's one person in the other car, but that person happens to be injured very severely, the most they would be able to collect is the $250,000, which means you would potentially be exposed if what the claim was worth more than that. You know, you'd either, if you had an umbrella, obviously that would take care of a larger exposure. But if not, anything over $250,000, you know, could fall on you. Now, it takes a very significant injury to get to $250,000. They're not common, but they certainly happen, and we see them on a fairly regular basis. I think you're much better off with a single limit policy because, again, if only one person is hurt, or let's say one person's hurt severely and two others have relatively minor injuries, you know, that person, you can pay $300 or $350 or whatever and then still have enough money under your $500 to cover the others. If all you've got is $250,000, that's the most any one person's going to get.
All right, there we go.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. On to Diane in Tomahawk next. Hi, Diane.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Increasingly, we have local communities that are allowing ATVs and ATV-like UTVs on our county roads and local roads. And my question is, how are these insured? If I'm driving my car and I have an accident with someone who's driving an ATV on the road, are they covered by home insurance or what? Or do they get a new kind of insurance policy when they're driving these vehicles on roads?
Now, that's a great question. It's actually something I was hopefully going to get to at some point, but I'm glad you got to it first. You know, for the most part, ATVs and UTVs are not going to be covered under your auto policy. Sorry, they may well be covered under your homeowner's policy. The problem is most auto policies exclude vehicles that are not primarily intended for use on public roads. And they talk about, there's lots of different things that they talk about. Usually they won't cover something that's less than four wheels. Now, the UTVs have four wheels and so do some of the ATVs, but they will likely be excluded from coverage under the auto policy. And one of the problems is You know, Larry was talking about going down there, and obviously, not giving a hard time, but, you know, the time to talk to your agent is before you go and do things like that. None of us think of it. I don't think of it. You know, most lawyers I talk to don't think of it. But, you know, it's great to think about those things in advance, because if you have wreck vehicles, if you have something like that, you know, they probably aren't covered under auto. You want to make sure they are covered under your homeowners. You may need a rider. You likely don't, but that's something you should certainly talk, you know, to your insurance agent about and find out what you need to do to make sure that you have coverage when you're operating those. Because I can tell you that we see some really severe injury claims from snowmobiles, ATVs, UTVs. I had a really bad UTV claim just last year where UTV tipped over and the gas cap was probably not properly fastened. The child was, the young man who was involved was burned pretty severely. There's just a lot of potential. You know, in our cars, we're surrounded by a lot of metal, and heaven knows bad things can happen in cars too. But a relatively minor impact is unlikely to cause a serious injury in a car. A relatively minor impact when you're in a UTV or ATV can really cause very severe injuries. So go to your insurance agent. Be sure that's covered under, you know, under your homeowner's policy, or check to be sure that's the case. From your standpoint, you hope they've got coverage, because I can tell you that a lot of people don't bother to check whether they're covered or not.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much, Dan, for calling. Great question. Well, they've all been great questions. Melissa in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Larry. Thank you so much for taking my call. Sure. I just want to say I love, love, love your show so much.
Thank
you. But my question is, we're having trouble getting insurance for my son. He's 20 years old. He's a high school graduate. He works full-time, and he's trying to purchase an auto. He's got an overqualified cosigner, and they've given him just a basic limit of $10,000. And when we call for insurance, like, one of the lowest quotes we've gotten is probably about $400 a month.
Holy,
is that, yeah, is that normal, or are we not calling the right places, or are we getting overinsured on some of these things?
Does he still live in your household?
No, he does not.
Okay. You know, I check on a couple things. One, that seems, you know, and I'm not an insurance agent, and I'm not trying to play one on radio either, but, you know, that seems like an awful lot of money. Who have you gone to? We're going to talk. Well, let's talk right now. You know, there are different places to buy insurance. Obviously, you have the captive agents, and that sounds awful, but they are captives. American Family, State Farm, you know, there are companies like that who have their own agents and their own agents group. And they just sell their policies, no one else. The other people that, you know, are independent agents, and they usually will sell for multiple companies. I mean, they don't sell for 30 or 40, I don't think, normally, but they'll sell for more than one company, and they may have quite a number available. They're probably better placed to shop and try to find you a policy that works and that isn't that expensive. I mean, that really is just bizarrely expensive.
I mean, we have called State Farm and Farmers and Geico and Allied. I mean, we've really called a lot of people. And, you know, those, like, 400 seems to be the going rate. And we're thinking, are they giving him too, like, you know, your bank says go out and get full coverage, you know, and then you call and you say, well, we need full coverage. Are they giving us higher, like, minimums than he would need?
What are they telling you that the limits are that you're purchasing, the liability insurance limits? Do you know?
If I can remember correctly, I think they're like $100,000, $50,000,
yeah,
something like that.
5,100 is pretty common, too.
Yeah.
I mean, you should probably ask about the 2,550. And look, if you can afford more, I think it's a good idea to have more. If you're a young person starting out and you don't have a lot of assets, and he probably doesn't, so that, you know, then the need for a 25,000 or 100, 300 or 5,100 instead of the 2,550 is obviously a lot less. And so maybe that's the first thing I'd check out is see. But most of the companies that call themselves non-standard companies, American Family has one, Dairyland is one, Vikings one, they're both part of Sentry. There's a number of others out there. The first thing I'd do is go to an independent agent, though, and see if an agent can shop somebody. Now, it sounds like Progressive and Geico do sell through independent agents. They also sell direct. But I'd go and check with a couple of independent agents, because they should know you know, who writes policies, you know, for kids in that age group. And they aren't all the same, although I know you've said that you seem to be getting pretty much the same answer. That's the first thing I do is check with an independent agent. I'd also check on what it would cost for the minimum limits, the $2,550, because in terms of protecting his assets, that's probably all he needs. I mean, yeah. God forbid something happens, you know, the worst case scenario, you can almost always declare bankruptcy if something like that happened. Again, it's highly unlikely that would even be necessary because generally, if somebody...
Or if we thought he was, you know, a bad driver or anything like that, so...
Yeah, that's the thing. He doesn't have a bad driving record, it sounds like.
No, he doesn't at all. He has no driving... I mean, he's got no tickets, no nothing.
I'm really surprised that they would charge that guy.
We are, too.
Try to reach out to a couple independent agents and see what they tell you, because I can't believe they can't find a company that'll write you at least basic coverage for a lot less than that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good luck.
So maybe ask for more of like a basic coverage instead of full coverage.
I'd just say, I'm glad you mentioned that term because you get that all the time. And, you know, I don't know what full coverage is in a sense. I mean, is full coverage, you know, a 100, 300 with a $2 million umbrella, or is it, you know, 100, 300, but no umbrella? I mean, it varies depending on your circumstances. And he obviously needs a lot less insurance than you do, or than somebody who's older and has worked for longer and has built up some assets. So I think in his case, a $2,550 is perfectly acceptable. And that's what I'd ask them about that. And I'd go through at least one independent agent and maybe a couple and just see if they can't shop and find you a better deal.
Yeah, good luck.
Oh, excellent. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks, Melissa. And Sandy in Cottage Grove,
excuse me,
up next. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. And thank you for being on the air with this topic.
Oh, thanks.
Yep, my question is, we have a daughter in college who will be moving out of the dorms and renting. And my question is, where we own a farm and we have a farm ranch policy with one of your bigger local vendors in the area. I won't say who. But my question is, can we bundle her renter insurance in with our policy, or does she need her totally independent policy as a first-time renter in college?
You know, my guess is that you probably could get her included under your family policy. I mean, you need, obviously, renter's insurance, which would be probably an additional coverage to what you have because you obviously own. But given that, I'd check with the agent with whatever company you're with right now and see if they can't include that on the family policy, because when that happens, your rates go down. Obviously, it's going to be less expensive to do that than it is to purchase a separate policy. And it may also be possible to get higher limits at a lower cost if you do it that way. So I'd check with your agent. But to me, the answer may well be that, yes, you can include that through your family policy. Companies generally are interested in writing more coverage, not less. I mean, that's how they make money. So if they can write something else and include it on your policy, they'll generally be happy to do that.
And here's an interesting addition to that. Chris in Onalaska says, my daughter will be moving into an apartment with two other girls. Do they each have to get their own renter's insurance, or can one girl get the insurance with the other two listed as additional insured? If all three can be listed on one policy, is that a good idea?
Probably not. And I'll give you a couple examples of why not. A few years ago, and this comes up more often than you'd think, we had a group of girls, there were six of them, I believe, living in the same apartment. They went away, allegedly didn't turn the heat way down. There was, you know, freezing, the pipes burst, there was a lot of damage. And at the end of the day, the insurance company for the person who owned the building paid the damage. But then, of course, they turned around and said, okay, you guys should pay this because it's your fault. Now, we were able to work that out in the end. But fortunately, we had at least half the girls had renter's insurance. I think four out of six, actually. And those that did, you know, got lawyers, and we were able to work the thing out in a favorable way. But that's one of the problems, is if something happens that's a collective responsibility, you're cooking and you leave something on the stove and it sets the place on fire. One, you may not get, if you have personal possessions, they're not going to be covered on somebody else's renter's policy. So that's one of the problems. If you're liable for something, I don't know, and you'd have to check, but I'm not at all certain that a company would really write it that way, where they'd write coverage, but in effect cover all three people. My guess is they won't. But even assuming they would, again, if one person has a dog and that dog bites someone, if one person is out skateboarding and runs down a little old lady skateboarding, I mean, there are a number of situations where that renter's insurance would probably kick in. And it may not if you've only got one person buying the coverage.
Along these lines, again, David in Madison wonders, do kids in dorms need renter's insurance, or is it covered by the college?
No, it probably isn't covered. Well, certainly their personal possessions aren't going to be covered by the college. I mean, obviously, even if you're renting an apartment that's a private apartment, I mean, if the thing gets struck by lightning and does a bunch of damage to the building, if there's a fire in the whole building, they certainly would be responsible for redoing your apartment, redoing your dorm. But in the case of the dorm, you've got personal property. And if things, is in your case, Larry, if things get stolen, you know, and that happens and everywhere, but college campuses as well, you know, if something expensive gets stolen or a bunch of things get stolen, that's not going to be covered by the college. And it's probably not going to be, it certainly wouldn't be covered by, you know, a private dormitory or an apartment or anything like that. So it's important to have the coverage if you have something to lose. If you're not going to purchase renter's insurance, at least check to see if your son, daughter, whatever, would be covered at school by your homeowner's insurance in case there is something they do that creates a liability. It may well not be, but that's important to know in making that decision. Renter's insurance, again, is not terribly expensive. It's like all insurance. You know, you probably don't need it, and that's why people don't think about it. I never think about it on a daily basis, even though I see things on a daily basis that should make me think about it. Because, you know, you don't expect your home to burn down. You don't expect to be burglarized. You know, you don't expect something like that to happen. And you don't expect that you might be doing something aside from in your car where you might cause somebody an injury. Just don't think about those things. And they don't occur very often. But when they do, if you don't have insurance, it can be devastating.
It sure can. I was thinking about another instance in my own home where we have there's a sprinkler system in the home. And while we were away for the day, the sprinkler in the walls broke.
Oh, golly.
So we came home to the wall all wet and floor wet. And it's a good thing we weren't gone for the week or something. Golly. But the insurance the insurance company stood, you know, took care of everything. We got it fixed right away because it had to be fixed right away or you were going to have mold in the walls and so forth. And I was really happy I had that insurance.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, the losses, you know, when you pay the darn premium every month, it is frustrating. But, boy, you can have a loss that just, you know, is so out of proportion to what you pay every month for the premium. It's really important.
Richard in Ettrick, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hey, Larry. Great show. Question I've got is an uninsured motorist. As I realize that Wisconsin now, you require to have insurance to operate a vehicle. Is that correct?
It is correct.
Okay, so when a policy lapses, when a person quits paying on their policy, why doesn't the insurance company send a little bleep to the DMV so they can pull those people's license or whatever? Because I had a friend just had an accident. Somebody told their car sitting out in front of their house. Of course, they didn't have any insurance, so they're still driving around.
No, they are, unfortunately. And, you know, while insurance is mandatory, enforcement is not. And there doesn't seem to me, at least, to be a lot of effort to enforce that. I think your question's a great one because I think that would make absolute sense. I suppose it would impose, you know, something of a burden on the DMV or on the insurance company. I'm sorry, not the DMV. But I think they should be doing that because if you don't, you've got that risk. Now, the problem is there are a lot of people who just never buy insurance, period. And when they don't, nothing much happens until there's an accident. Now, once they've had an accident and they don't have insurance, they're going to get their driver's license pulled. So there are consequences. I mean, it's not as if they get away scot-free. Now, some of them will drive without a license, as you and I know. But, I mean, those consequences keep multiplying because if you do that, the penalties go up real quickly and become jail time pretty quickly. But your idea is a good one. I don't think that's done. I can't say no with certainty, but I don't believe it is, and I think it's something that should be done. But it also tells you that even with mandatory insurance, two things are true. One, there are a lot of people that mandatory or not do not buy it. And we still see, you know, uninsured motorist claims on a very regular basis. I don't think, honestly, I see them any less often than I did before it was mandatory. And the other thing it tells you is, you know, even with mandatory insurance, the mandatory is $25,000 per person. And as we said at the outset, that isn't much these days. So that's why underinsured motorist coverage is so important, as well as uninsured.
And Richard, thanks again. I appreciate your comment. We've got some other emails as well. By the way, if you have a question, we have open lines now and get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Julie in Onalaska emailed, when considering a settlement, all right, let's say you're injured, how do you calculate a fair amount for pain and suffering? Does it have anything to do with actual medical costs incurred?
Yeah, another great question, and it's something that's been talked about for years, and people have all sorts of different impressions. When I was a younger lawyer, people often talked about a claim, those damages, which lawyers call general damages, the pain and suffering and loss of enjoyment of life. They're apart from medical bills and any lost income you might have and any other actual out-of-pocket expenses. And people used to say, well, it's 3 to 5 times specials, and the specials are the medical and any loss of wage. That was never really true, and it's still not. Now, I think a lot of lawyers talk more about 2 times specials. And a lot of mediators that I work with, you know, will use that as kind of a benchmark. There isn't any rule of thumb. I mean, there isn't some sort of mathematical computation you can make. But, you know, and the reason for that is this. I mean, you can have, like I said, we see sometimes emergency room bills for $20,000 and more. They may all be diagnostic. Now, that doesn't mean you're not entitled to that. You are. But, you know, it does mean that it may be that in a couple, 3 months, you're fine. They were worried. Yeah. They thought they needed to do this because it was a really bad accident, but you have a good recovery. And at the end of the day, you may not have a great deal of long-term pain, suffering, and loss of enjoyment of life. So it does vary. And, I mean, you can have very minor. I see people with relatively minor medical bills because they don't like to treat a lot and they don't want to do that, and they get as good as they're going to get, and they just say that's enough. They don't do a lot of diagnostic testing, and yet they have a significant long-term impact on their life because they have a neck pain or back pain or something like that that's with them for years and years, probably their life. I mean, I hurt my neck in an accident 30 years ago, and I still feel it on the right side of my neck. Not terrible, but it's there. Yeah. So, you know, again, while there's not some sort of automatic rule of thumb, if you look at something like that, it's probably not unusual. I've had a lot of mediators say, look, the jury's going to give at least as much as the medical bills. And then the question is, how much are they going to give beyond that? When we're looking at cases, we you know, certainly look to do better than just matching the medical bills. But it is highly individual.
You know, and I was thinking about, as you were talking, I was thinking, well, what about, you know, do you want to settle right away? Or, you know, there I could feature something where, okay, you feel pretty good, but then 3 months from now,
you know, that,
you're not. And
that's a great point, Larry. I mean, we see this constantly where people, first of all, when you get in an accident and you're injured, you're going to get contacted by the insurance company. Insurance companies very often will push an early settlement. And they do that because they know they're going to pay less money in the long run if they can get your case settled early on. And the pitch is often, look, we'll pay your medical bills, and we'll pay your medical bills for the next 6 months, and we'll give you $1,000, $5,000, whatever the amount might be. And people often are tempted to do that. I mean, people have financial needs, and especially when they've been in an accident. And people often think, and it's understandable, people say, well, this isn't that bad. I'm going to get better. And many, many people do. I'm not suggesting that everyone who's in an accident has a permanent injury, but there is a significant subset of people that don't get better, and particularly with what we call soft tissue injuries, which are injuries to your neck and back generally. They can be in other areas of the body, but those are the most common injuries you get in an automobile accident. And, you know, insurance companies kind of downplay those injuries. They're real, and they can be a real problem in your life. And often people start feeling a little better after the, you know, the normal pattern in an accident is, you know, right away people often don't feel much pain at all because you get an adrenaline rush,
right.
And, you know, you're thinking about everything else. And then you go to the ER, if you go to an emergency room, and they do x-rays or other testing, and they say, well, the x-rays are negative. And everybody breathes a sigh of relief and
yeah.
says, oh, good, I'm fine. Well, not really, because in almost probably 90% of the cases I see, maybe 95%, x-rays are negative. And the problem isn't that. It's the ligaments and tendons and muscles and all those things that can go on to give you a lot of trouble. And often the pattern there is, you know, it gets worse after the first day or the first few hours. And sometimes people say 2 or 3 days later, even a week later, then it gets a little bit better. And people are starting to get better. They're feeling a little better. And they say, oh, you know, the company calls and says, hey, here's what we're willing to do. And they say, yeah, you know, I'm feeling better. I'll probably be fine. We always tell people to make sure you wait a significant amount of time. I mean, even when clients say, I feel, you know, I think I'm okay now, I always say, give it 60 days. And if you are, wonderful. I mean, the best
yeah.
thing that can happen to my clients is to get better. I don't want
yeah.
clients to have a long-term problem. But I always tell them, wait till we're really certain. One thing in Wisconsin that's classic is, you know, we're seasonal, as everybody
yeah.
knows to their sorrow. And, you know, you do different things in the winter than you do in the spring and the fall and the summer. And, you know, particularly if you're injured in the winter and you're not doing all those, you're not biking, you're not
yeah.
playing tennis, you're not golfing. And then you get to summer and all of a sudden all those muscles you really weren't using for the same things, you go, ooh, ouch, you know, I tried
yeah.
to kayak again and that really hurt. And so that's why we tell people to wait. And I understand that for people, you know, particularly who have financial issues, it's difficult to wait, but you're so much better off to give it another 30 or 60 days after you think you're okay to make sure that's true. The other thing, and the question that was asked is, you know, call a lawyer. If you have a question about that, people call me. I'm happy to talk to them. You know, I'll give you some quick advice. I mean, if you really need a lawyer, fine, but you don't need a lawyer for everything. But it's often a good idea to at least talk to a lawyer and get some sense of whether you're at a point where you should settle the claim and maybe some idea about, you know, what it is, you know, is fair to settle that claim.
Mike Riley, our guest today, third-generation Madison attorney, partner in the Axley Law Firm. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at insurance and personal injury on our show today, Larry Mueller here with Mike Riley from the Axley Law Firm of Madison. Every one of our lines is filled, so we'll go right back to the phones and to Ted in Toma. Ted, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking the call. A few years back, my son was in a car accident. And what happened was it was a four-way controlled intersection. The person on the right tried to sneak through on the yellow or whatever they were doing, but they pretty much came through on the red. So he hit them. And there was a car right next to him, which we were talking after the accident. Man, that girl blew that red light. You know, and everybody there, but my son being in college, didn't get any names. There was someone else who made a 911 call to the police about the accident. And to make a long story short, our insurance company ended up paying for the whole mess, which really irritates me. And we did not have full coverage. So I'm thinking, was that the difference that no one would investigate this and look into this and get the 911 call and try to contact witnesses and... is that the technicality there? Because I went and talked to some attorneys, like, said, this isn't right, you know, but they all just would rather ignore me. Is there something there that I was missing?
No, I don't think so. So did you have 2550 at that time, or is that what you had for coverage?
Well, we had some kind of just liability. It was an older vehicle.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, and a lot of people do that. I mean, you don't need, you know, comprehensive coverage or collision coverage because they just cover the vehicle and not much point in paying a lot of money for that if you're talking about an older vehicle. And generally speaking, I'll get to your question specifically, but generally speaking, you know, if you're going to scrimp on that, not on the liability coverage or the uninsured or underinsured, because that's a car, and if it's only worth $1,500, there's not a lot of loss risk there, but, you know, the other things can be very different. You know, it's the question you asked is difficult. I don't, obviously, I haven't seen all the facts, but we have an intersection accident, and we see this a lot, where you have, you know, both sides saying, I had the green, I had the green. normally your company, most companies will pay a good deal of attention to what their insured says. Now, they're not going to just accept that if everybody else says, no, no, he's mistaken. You know, he had the red light. But where you've got people like that, I'm surprised they wouldn't do more of an investigation. Did the police come to the scene?
Yes.
What did the police officer say?
We never found out. That was the fishy part.
Yeah, you should. Was there a report?
Yes, and there was that was really vague. And there was an officer's name that we could not contact or would not be talked to. And we'd never, and no one would release the 911 call, which I thought was kind of public information.
Yeah, you should. I mean, certainly if a lawyer wanted to get that, he could get that. I don't know how much difference that would have made. I mean, one of the things I see a lot doing what I do is this, is companies and individual adjusters within companies just react so differently to claims. I mean, we settle claims, not nearly as many as I'd like, but we settle claims where somebody pays us a lot of money where I think there are really significant issues and I'm concerned about those issues, and yet they pay a lot of money. I have other claims where I think they're fairly straightforward and they, you know, fight tooth and nail over paying money. So the answer is likely, you know, your insurance. One, insurance companies aren't going to pay a lot of attention to you. When you have a claim, whether you want them to settle or don't want them to settle, they don't much care. I mean, the days when they did are gone. And there used to be a time when your agent, especially if you were with an agent who just wrote one company, but any agent could, if you were a good insured, he could call up and have some influence. Those days are gone. I mean, they really don't care what the agent says, and they don't much care what you say either. They're going to do what they think is in their financial best interest, period.
Oh, there we go. Sorry for that, Ted, but It's just too bad.
Well, and one other thing I should say, Larry, you know, when you go to lawyers, Ted, you know, what they're going to, most lawyers, I mean, if you came to me in that situation, one of the things I'd say is, look, if your insurance company is going to take care of this and you're not going to be involved and have to spend a lot of time or money, you know, that may be the best way to go. And the bottom line is, as a lawyer, I couldn't control what your insurance company does anyway. I mean, I could call them up and say, hey, Ted's hired me, and we'd really like to see you take another look at this. And they'd go, eh, really?
Oh, thanks again, Ted, for calling. Appreciate it. Terry in Boyceville, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I hope you can help me.
Okay.
Yeah, we hope so, too.
Yes. I hired a contractor. We signed no papers between the two of us to re-side my house. He did a really bad job because the siding is still falling off. It's been less than a year, but the vinyl siding is coming down. He put pieces in that were 8 inches long in spots. He did not wrap the garage in one whole piece. He wrapped it in several pieces, the garage by the garage door. And I had searched for lawyers that would even listen to me about this situation. I finally found one, and she told me, I really have no recourse because all the laws are set towards contractors. So he put a lien on the house. We paid it within a month. Because I paid him a little over half when he asked for the money, and then he wouldn't even come back and fix the mistakes. And so I held the other half, and so he put a lien on us, and we had to pay it. Do I have anything to go on?
Yeah, I think you do. I think, you know, I understand. I mean, first of all, I don't agree at all that, you know, favors contractors or, you know, average person can't do anything. You can. How much was involved? How much money?
A little over $7,000.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the options you have is small claims court, because the small claims court jurisdiction goes up to $10,000 now. So you could actually bring it, even without a lawyer, you could bring an action in small claims court. And in my experience, the small claims court judges are really fairly sympathetic to the average person who's just representing themselves. One of the problems he's got is that's not, whatever insurance he has will almost certainly not cover that, because it's the quality of his work. And if he burned down part of your house or, you know, knocked down your garage with his truck, that his insurance would cover that. This is probably going to have to come out of his pocket. It's always more difficult to get people to reach into their pocket than it is to deal with an insurance company. But, you know, first of all, I'd call the lawyer referral service for the State Bar of Wisconsin. We've talked about that before, but just if you look under State Bar of Wisconsin, there's something called the Lawyer Referral and Information Service, and they may be able to find somebody who would help. Even if you can't get a lawyer, you can certainly bring a small claims action yourself. You go down to the courthouse, you get the forms, they'll fill them out. And you can bring pictures and you can talk to him and show him what happened. I mean, he's going to tell his side of the story, too. But, you know, I think that's certainly worth doing, even if you can't get a lawyer to help you. And I would hope you could.
Small claims court. And just go to the courthouse.
Go to the courthouse. They've got all the forms. You fill out the forms. They'll actually, I mean, they'll do a lot of it for you. And then when you get to the point, they'll schedule a hearing. Now, you know, maybe he'll call and try to work it out with you, but he sounds like, frankly, sounds like a bum, so he may not. And if he doesn't, then, you know, you're going to go to a hearing, and you can come in and you can testify, you can bring pictures in and show them what was done. I think that's certainly worth pursuing if you can't find a lawyer. The other thing is, as you said from the outset, I mean, it's a good idea to have a signed agreement, but you know what? In this case, I don't see how it makes much difference, because the problem here is that he just didn't do good work, period. And I think that would have been true whether you signed an agreement with him or not. But consider those options.
And you might also give a call to the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection and file a complaint with them as well. And I don't know if that's going to bring you anything, but they will also certainly look into things.
Yeah, no, that's a great idea, Larry.
Thank you so much for calling, Terry, and good luck to you. Well, lots of callers online here, and we're coming right up to our news break right now. So I'll tell you what. There is a line open for you at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at email us at ideas@wpr.org, or go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can post your questions there. We'll be back with our guest, Mike Riley, right after this look at the news. Taking a look at insurance today and personal injury with our guest, Mike Riley, third-generation Madison lawyer, partner in the Axley Law Firm in Madison. Great to have him with us today, and certainly thank you so much for joining us. Every one of our phone lines is filled, so we'll go right back to the phones and to Bob in Franklin. And Bob, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have a income property with liability. I have a home with liability, and the auto insurance is $250,500. But I own some acreage, rural acreage that has no buildings. Do I need a liability insurance for that?
It's hard to imagine what could happen that would make you liable. What's really, I mean, first of all, it's just hard to imagine, period, because the chances that somebody would be hurt on that in a way that makes you responsible. I mean, we keep talking about liability insurance, and what that means is that insurance covers if you're at fault. You do something that's negligent, that's below the normal standard of care that the average person uses. That's what exposes you to liability. It's not as if somebody walks on your property and is hurt, you're automatically liable. And in fact, in our state, you're nearly automatically not liable because, you know, first of all, again, there'd have to be something you did that was wrong, and it's hard to imagine what that would be. Secondly, Wisconsin has what's called a Recreational Immunity Act, and the Recreational Immunity Act basically says that if somebody's on your property for recreational purposes, you're immune from liability. You can't be liable under most circumstances. It would take something really unusual, and it's hard to imagine what that would be in this circumstance. So I really don't see any need to have liability coverage under those circumstances. I don't know, you know, what you'd be protecting against.
Yeah, there we go.
If I'm renting some of it to a farmer?
Well, you're renting it to someone, but again, his conduct is his conduct. So if you rent it to a farmer and he somehow, you know, runs
tips
over
his tractor
somebody with
over,
a tractor,
yeah.
You know, we've all seen these cases where the kid's riding on the tractor and something happens, and that's awful. But if that happens, again, that's, you didn't do that, and you have nothing to do with it. The mere fact that you rented him the property wouldn't be enough to make you legally responsible for that. So I really don't think that changes the picture. It wouldn't hurt to talk to an insurance agent and just see. I'm sure the cost would be nominal, but in all honesty, it's hard to see what sort of risk you'd be running under those circumstances.
All right. Thanks, Bob. Appreciate the call. Brenda in Racine, it's your turn now. Hi, Brenda.
Hi, Brent. This is Brenda. I have a couple of questions for you.
Okay.
Earlier, you had spoken with a woman that had an 18-year-old that was being insured.
Yep.
And he was on his, or not an 18-year-old, he was 20-year-old being insured. And you'd asked him if he was still in the home. And I'd wondered, is there a difference? Would she be liable if he was still in the home and had insurance and her assets wouldn't be protected?
No, she wouldn't. First answer is you're not liable. The only time parents are liable in Wisconsin, there are a couple circumstances. The first is you sponsor your kid's license, but that generally runs out at 18, barring some really unusual circumstance. But if you're a sponsor, then you can be liable. If you're not a sponsor, then you're not automatically liable. We also, vehicle owners are not automatically liable either. People often think that, well, if I give somebody my vehicle and they have an accident, I'm going to be responsible. Your insurance probably would be because you always go to the car first. So if I'm driving Larry's car, then yeah. You know, they'd go to Larry's insurance and then they'd go to mine, so you'd have both. But generally speaking, no, parents aren't liable for that. If someone's living in the home, the question would be, you know, can you then insure them through your policy? But the mere fact that they're living in your home would not make you legally responsible for an accident they had.
Well, thank you so much. The other question, and as far as injury goes, it was a medical situation, and apparently none of the lawyers would touch it in the state of Wisconsin because my husband did not die. He ended up with a brain tumor, and the physician neglected to take a look at the MRI, and he fled the state. Now, I went after, thought that maybe medical liability might be the way to go, but everybody has said that if he's not dead, it's not feasible for them to take the case, and I thought maybe we should go after it as an injury.
Yeah,
rather than medically.
Sure. Well, that's it's a difficult topic. It is extremely difficult to get anyone to take a medical malpractice case, a case where, you know, the allegation is that the doctor didn't use appropriate care in diagnosing or performing a procedure. The reason for that, there are a number of them. First of all, they're very expensive cases because the lawyer has to go out, find an expert or experts who will attest that, one, this person didn't use the appropriate degree of care, and two, that failure actually caused an injury. And because of the expense and because they're very difficult to win, they almost never settle. Some do, but it's a rarity. I mean, I handle primarily auto cases and cases like that where someone's injured through somebody else's negligence that's not professional. We settle 98% of those cases at least. When you go into the medical malpractice field, you're probably settling 5% if you're lucky, and the rest go to trial. And if you go to trial, the defense wins. I think the latest numbers were around 80%. So, you know, you can imagine that when you're doing these on a contingent fee basis, so you only get paid if you win or if you get a settlement, and you're faced with incurring, you know, you can easily spend $100,000 or more, in some cases a lot more, just to get one of those cases to trial and through trial. So you can understand why lawyers are reluctant to take them, and that's the unfortunate reality. It is really difficult to find someone unless the damages are, you know, probably close to $1 million.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much for calling, Brenda. Appreciate it. I want to give Diane in Waupaca a chance to join us. Hi, Diane. Thank you.
Good morning. I have a question about our pontoon boat. We have an older pontoon boat, and a friend of ours allows us to keep it during the summer at the dock at his cottage on the lake. Recently, my husband decided, actually last season, that we could get some extra money by renting this out on weekends where we weren't using it. So we have been doing that, and we don't have any insurance because it's older, in particular on the boat itself. But I'm wondering, are we liable if he rents it to somebody and they would, let's say, hit another boat or injure a person who was in the water, or if they were driving it back to the dock and hit the dock and did damage to the person who's allowing us to use the property, damage to that property, would we be liable?
Short answer is no. And as always with lawyers, there's a longer answer. you know, I would, first of all, I'd check your homeowners, because your homeowners might actually cover that, even though you don't have, you know, even though the dot that's not at your house, the homeowners may cover that. I'd just check with your agent and see what the case is. I mean, they're not going to cover damage to the boat, but that's not what you're after. You just want to be sure you're not responsible. Sort of as we just discussed when we were talking about vacant property, I mean, if someone else is using your boat and it, and they have an accident, that's not your problem. They're the ones who are going to be responsible for that legally. You're not. The concern would be if there was something wrong with the boat, if they said, well, I tried to shift it in reverse, or the steering broke and I ran into someone because the steering broke. That might be a maintenance issue where somebody could say, well, you didn't take proper care of the boat, and that's why that happened. But if all we're talking about is, as you said earlier, they come into the dock and smash into the dock because they don't throw it into reverse early enough. Now, if they say, I couldn't get it into reverse because it didn't work, then you might have something of an issue. But the vast majority of the things you'd be talking about, you're not going to be liable for somebody else's conduct. The exception to that with a car or a boat or anything else is the negligent entrustment theory. And negligent entrustment just says, if you give somebody a car who you know has had 14 OWIs in the last 6 years, driving while intoxicated, in the last years, or is a horrible driver and you know they are and they drive 100 miles an hour, then you might have a problem with negligent entrustment. And I suppose you could say the same thing with the boat. But with the boat, you almost certainly don't have any idea who you're giving the boat to. And so you'd have no reason. I mean, you wouldn't be negligent for giving them the boat, because you'd have no reason to think that they can't operate the boat. So I think generally that risk is if not non-existent, close to it.
All right. There we go. Thank you for calling. And Mark in Grafton, it's your turn. Hi, Mark.
Good afternoon, Mike and Larry. My question is involving, I do want to go to small claims court, but should I go and represent myself or my lawyer? And the story is that a FedEx truck hit my parked car. The insurance went to an adjuster that they worked with, non-FedEx. And I knew I was in problems, in trouble when I saw the poor Google reviews from people that dealt with them. Anyway, it was a long process. I have an email in which they promised me to fix the car, pay for my insurance deductible, and fully pay for a rental car until the car was ready. Well, they never paid me my $1,000 deductible. They stiffed me for $280 of auto rental that they stopped paying without me knowing. And so do you think this – now I'm not dealing with FedEx exactly. Or am I? I'm going with their adjuster. So do I need a lawyer?
I don't think so. I mean, that's outrageous. And the first thing I'd do, I think I'd go to FedEx directly. I don't care if the adjuster, I'd go to FedEx. I'd write them a letter to customer relations or whatever and say, you know, I've always thought you were a good company, and now I have some severe questions, and tell them what happened. I can't believe FedEx would want that to happen. I mean, it's not that I think corporations are wonderful, including FedEx, although my brother worked for him for about 30 years. But and he didn't think they were that wonderful sometimes either. At any rate, you know, I just can't believe that they want that. That's at the end of the day, they're going to lose money on it. They have to hire a lawyer. They can't come into court without a lawyer. But, I mean, this is so straightforward. I don't really think you need a lawyer to come in and say, here's what happened. Here's what they promised me. They haven't done it. I mean, your lawyer can make that pitch for you, but it seems to me that that's a simple enough pitch you can make yourself. But I'd go direct to FedEx first, because sometimes they don't know what's going on. They hire these claims outfits. Some of them are okay. Some of them aren't. And like I said, individual adjusters, some of them are great, are really decent people and fine to deal with, and some of them are awful, and it sounds like you ran into one of the awful ones.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you, Mark, and good luck. Appreciate your call. Jenny in Madison, it's your turn next. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I guess a little bit similar to the last caller, I had someone hit me in my car. It was pretty clearly their fault. They were backing up on East Washington Avenue here in Madison.
Mm-hmm.
So they pulled him over, or we called the police, and he had no insurance. And so he did about $7,000 worth of damage to my car, but I had to pay $1,000 deductible, and then I haven't been able to recover that. They couldn't recover it from him, so I didn't get it. Can I take him to small claims court for that?
Absolutely. Yeah, no,
and is there,
go ahead.
is there a statute of limitations? Because this happened about 3 or 4 years ago, and it's just been bothering me. I see this guy around. And,
yeah. It's always been 6 years for property damage. I'd have to look again because we don't get a lot of those claims, but I think it is still 6 years. And at any rate, I'm almost certain it'd be six because they changed it quite recently. But I think your accident goes back to before they changed it, and the changes only apply to accidents that happen after the new statute comes in force. So I'm virtually certain you're dealing with a six-year statute, and you certainly could go to small claims and pursue that.
Okay.
All right, good. Samantha in Whitehall had similar question. What happens when you're in an accident with an uninsured driver and they are at fault? Who pays? Does my insurance pay?
Yeah, there are a couple different answers. I mean, depending on what happens. If you're injured, that's where you go to your own uninsured motorist coverage. So if you have an injury and this guy doesn't have coverage, you contact your company, tell them you're going to be making an uninsured motorist claim. They're going to want medical bills and records and things. And depending on the severity of the injury, you may want to see if you can deal with it yourself or hire a lawyer. And as I've said before, you can talk to a lawyer frequently without having to hire him. Nobody that I know ever charges for a consultation to just talk to somebody on the phone or, for that matter, in person, at least not in the personal injury area. It may be different if you're doing, you know, a business thing or something else. But generally speaking, I think it's worth talking to a lawyer about it. If we're talking about property damage, then if your company, if you have collision coverage and somebody else hits you, then your collision coverage will take care of that. They'll actually take care of it whether, you know, there's the other person has insurance or not. You can always go to your own company if you see fit, and then they'll turn back to his company and try to get the money back. I often tell people to have both people look at it because sometimes you get a better offer from one company than the other if you can do it either through your own company or through the other guy's company. Now, if you do it through your own company, there's going to be deductible, and then they generally will recover that deductible from the other party. But that's the way to approach that if the other person doesn't have coverage. Now, if you don't have collision coverage, then you're going to have to recover any damage to the vehicle from the other party personally if you're able to do that, and it's never a treat trying to do that.
Ann in Decorah, Iowa has another interesting question. Would you recommend a dashboard camera for the average person? It seems like it could help with the facts if something happened. And then she also says, if you have a dashboard camera, are you required to show the footage, share the footage?
Those are really good questions. One, I guess the simple answer is I don't think you really need a dashboard camera. Even though doing what I do, it feels like people are in accidents daily. The fact is most people are not in an accident in their lifetime that's going to have, you know, serious ramifications where you have a serious injury or somebody else on the other side is seriously injured. I'm not saying it hurts to do it, and it's always a good idea after an accident, now that everybody has cell phone cameras, to take some pictures right there of both vehicles and kind of the intersection to give a sense of where things were, and that is a good practice. I don't think you need a dashboard camera. If you had one, it's interesting. At the end of the day, if you got involved in a lawsuit, you'd probably have to share that. I'm sure you'd end up having to share it. If you don't get involved in a lawsuit, you don't ever have to give anybody anything. And when it comes to insurance companies, you're not required to give them something. Now, if you refuse to give them something, they may decide not to pay you. But generally speaking, until you get involved in a lawsuit, you know, anything you give to an insurance company, you're doing voluntarily, in effect.
Jeannie in Sparta, let's go to you next. Hi, Jeannie. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you. My husband and I are hosting our nephew's wedding in our backyard in July. And our question is, we want to know if we will be liable for anyone getting hurt after they leave our house. We've hired a bartender. We asked our insurance agent if we could buy some sort of event rider, and our insurance does not offer that. And we just want to know how liable we are. He had said if my husband and I were the ones getting married, there wouldn't be a problem. But we are not the ones getting married.
Yeah. Well, so let's say somebody, you know, unbeknownst to everybody, somebody drinks one too many and gets in an accident on the way home. And somebody else gets hurt.
Normally in Wisconsin, given our very strong tradition of brewing, there are protections for that. We have dram shop laws. We have other laws that essentially say that as a social host, you're generally not responsible for injuries caused by someone who gets intoxicated at your home. What I do is this. In this case, you know, I'd ask you to give me a call at the office because I can take another look at something. I want to look at something specifically. And if you look up Axley on the web, AXLEY, it's axley.com. If you just take a look at our website, you can get my name and number and everything. It's Mike Riley. And I'd be happy to give you a little more information. What I would tell you right now is I don't think you have any exposure in that situation. The one exception is minors. If you're serving minors and they're intoxicated and they cause an accident, that can be a real problem. And so I'd be very concerned with that. But again, if you're hiring a bartender, I'd rely on him to check. And, you know, if he's checking and if he fails, then, again, I think you're probably okay. You know, these situations don't occur very often. We litigated one of these years ago, had a case involving this, where it was a big party, and somebody got intoxicated and then caused really severe injuries. And I know in that case, at least, we were not able to persuade the court that the individual who was having the party should be liable. I'm really curious about your agent's advice. To me is highly suspect, I must say, and I hope your agent isn't listening and mortally offended. I just don't see how it makes any difference at all. I mean, if it's whether it's your wedding or anyone else's, any liability you would have would be because you're hosting the party and you're doing things. It's your conduct. It's not the wedding party's conduct that would be at issue. And in this case, you know, it'd be interesting. I mean, if you're hiring a bartender and the bartender works for a service, then they would probably have some coverage. But again, I think the simple answer is it's likely that you don't have any exposure. But if you want to give me a call, I can probably give you a little more detailed answer.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. And Jeff in Grand Marsh, I think we may have answered this question already, but let's hear it. Jeff?
You did get close.
Maybe we can do better this time.
I occasionally loan out my pickup and trailer, and my wife says, I wish you wouldn't do that. We are not covered, loaning the vehicle to somebody. And I said, of course we are. It's the vehicle that's insured. And she says, no, it says, we are, you and I. And I said, no, it's the vehicle. Doesn't matter who's driving. It could be stolen. Somebody gets in an accident. The vehicle is covered and will cover anybody injured. Who's right? Who's wrong?
Well, you're right on the major question, but wrong on the last one. So let's get at this quickly. What happens is this, is you're right about the vehicle. The coverage goes with the vehicle. The vehicle coverage is primary. So if you loan this to a buddy and he gets in an accident and hurts somebody, your coverage is going to come in first. And then if for any reason that's not enough, then his coverage would step in next. The only thing, and the basis for that is there are additional insureds. So you and your wife and your family members are named insureds generally, but there are additional insureds. And basically every policy says that if somebody is using the vehicle with your permission, they are an insured. Now, if somebody stole it, they wouldn't be using it with your permission, so they actually wouldn't be an insured. But in the every other circumstance we've talked about, you're absolutely right. You would be insured. The vehicle would be covered.
All right, there we go. And does in 30 seconds, can you tell us if a AAA company is better than a AA company and an A company?
Well, AAA and AA and single A really just talk about their reserves, and the likelihood that's ever going to be a problem is really small. If you're investing in them, yeah. If you're going out and buying an annuity for the next 50 years, I'd be concerned. For auto insurance, probably not a significant issue.
Well, Mike, this has been great. I'm going to go home and review my insurance, to be perfectly honest.
I probably will too, Larry.
Thank you so much. Michael Riley, a third-generation Madison lawyer, partner in the Axley Law Firm of Madison. Wasn't that great? I learned a lot, and I bet you did too. And I hopefully we'll be able to have him back and talk with him again. Just looking ahead tomorrow, Victoria Houston talks about her latest novel in the Loon Lake Mystery Series at 11:45. We'll be talking about the value of sports and entertainment memorabilia with our guests. Thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.